Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Bernadette Keogh, and in the early hours of Monday, July the 1st, these are our main stories. The French elections exit polls show that the National Rally of Marine Le Pen has won the biggest share of ballots in the first round of voting.
La démocratie a parlé.
Democracy has spoken, and the French voters have clearly expressed their wish to start afresh after 7 years of contemptuous and corrosive power.
12 out of 32 ministries in South Africa's new cabinet go to the opposition, in the first government to include non-ANC ministers since the advent of democracy. And the Prime Minister of St Vincent and the Grenadines tells us about the approach of Hurricane Beryl. Also in this podcast, the UN holds talks with the Afghan Taliban government in Qatar, is bringing them to the table, giving them implicit recognition. Australia introduces some of the world's toughest new regulations on vaping. And Islam meets heavy metal. The Indonesian hijab-wearing women who played Glastonbury. It seems that the French President Emmanuel Macron's gamble has spectacularly backfired. In the first round of his snap parliamentary election, his rival, the far-right National Rally Party, is projected to have come out on top, with exit polls predicting that it took 34% of the vote in the first round. A left-wing coalition came second on 28%, with Mr. Macron's centrist alliance trailing well behind on 22%. Marine Le Pen is the National Rally's leading figure, and she's been celebrating her party's success.
My dear compatriots, democracy has spoken, and the French people have placed the National Rally and its allies on top and have practically erased President Macron's bloc. To begin this change in government and drive the reforms that the country needs, we need an absolute majority in order for Jordan Bardella to be named in 8 days Prime Minister by Emmanuel Macron.
Leaders of the left and centre are now calling for voters to unite against Marine Le Pen in the second round next Sunday. Among them, France's Prime Minister, Gabriel Attal, who said the National Rally were at the gates of power.
Je le dis avec la force.
I say this with the force that the moment demands, to each and every one of our voters. Not a single vote must go to the National Rally.
With just 1 week to go until the crucial second round, is the National Rally's victory a foregone conclusion? A question for our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield.
Well, I mean, not quite yet. There is another round of voting, as she well knows. So everyone has gone home without any sort of overt rejoicing because they have to get back campaigning. There's a theoretical possibility that the Macron party and the left can come together by voting tactically and making arrangements to really keep down the number of MPs that are voted for the far right. But all that said, quite clearly, the victory is hers in this first round. And if the momentum is maintained, and so far the momentum through the European election to this election has been just simply upwards for the RN. If that momentum is maintained, then next Sunday we'll see her really being able to cry victory because they will have won this general election. The only question that really remains to be how big her victory is going to be, and will the party have this outright majority in Parliament, or will it be fall short of that key number of 289? And there's a big difference between the two, because if she can't get that number, she can't really govern because no one's going to join an alliance with her.
And what do you make of the Prime Minister's stance this evening in the wake of these polls?
Apart from anything else, he's simply sort of mouthing what President Macron said earlier on, which is everything should be done to keep out the National Rally. Now, there is nuance here, because earlier on in this campaign, Macron very publicly said that the battle was one of the centre, i.e. him, against the extremes on the right and the left. Right now, he seems to have come back to a more conventional position, saying, you know, left and centre, good, far right, bad. So left and centre come together to keep out the hard right.
If the National Rally does get into government, what will be the impact on French politics?
Well, enormous, simply enormous. A lot will depend, of course, on this question of whether it gets an outright majority or not. But, I mean, it will be an earthquake here and in Europe. French allies will be extremely troubled by the meaning of all this. I think what we can expect in the immediate term is, you know, a lot of pronouncements from the National Rally to the effect that they're not going to do anything dramatic. But, nonetheless, you know, they are a party with roots in the anti-Semitic past of the far right in France. It's going to be quite a bumpy ride. And above all, because we'll have this situation where we have a president of one party, that's Macron, and a prime minister and the government of the other party, a sworn enemy, they'll be at daggers drawn. But it'll be Macron who loses power, will move from the Élysée towards Hôtel Matignon, that is the residence of the prime minister. It'll be the prime minister who calls the shots.
Hugh Schofield. The vote was a resounding personal success for Ms. Le Pen, who was elected on first round votes alone. Our correspondent Rob Young is in her constituency, Enin Beaumont. He says there was already a party atmosphere there as her result came in.
In the moments before the first projections of the results were announced, the champagne was already flowing at this national rally party here. Hundreds of people had champagne flutes in their hands. They were already very much enjoying themselves. And when the projections were put on the giant screens here from one of the main French television channels, the place just erupted into cheering. People were jumping in the air. They were hugging each other. It really was a party atmosphere here. And then Marine Le Pen came onto the stage here. She addressed the adoring crowd. She said that she had won her constituency in the first round. It's being reported she's got 58% of the vote in the first round. That is the first time she has not had to go into a runoff, if confirmed. What we heard from Marine Le Pen in her speech to supporters, but she was very much aware because of the dozens of TV cameras at the back of the hall here that this was being watched by people far beyond this community centre in this small town in northeast France. She was trying to reach out, I think, beyond the hardcore supporters and those who have perhaps been flirting with the National Rally in this election because of their frustration with the state of public services or the squeeze on their living standards. And she said, we need an absolute majority. They are very much trying to say people do not need to be scared of this party. They're saying that it has changed. The problem when you go out and speak to people, even in this very town that Marine Le Pen represents, there is concern, there is a fear among some people that the National Rally may have changed their policies. They may talk in a different way, but their concern is that the party hasn't really reformed, and that is why it's going to be a struggle perhaps for the National Rally to persuade sufficient number of French people to give them, maybe lend them, their vote in a week's time.
Rob Young. A month after the ANC lost its majority in elections in South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced a new coalition cabinet. For the first time since the end of apartheid 30 years ago, the African National Congress will have to share power. After weeks of tense negotiations, the main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, will hold six posts. Our correspondent in Johannesburg, Shingai Nyoka, has this assessment of the new government.
Essentially, this was a juggling act for President Cyril Ramaphosa, and he alluded to that in his speech, that a government of national unity of this size was unprecedented in South Africa's history. He had to accommodate the interests of 11 political parties. So really in his announcement, I think a lot of people were looking to see just how diverse that cabinet and national executive would be. What he has done is essentially retain all the key ministries under the ANC's control, so international relations, where they have that very important policy of supporting the Palestinian cause, whereas other political parties within that government of national unity were opposed to that. He's also retained the ministerial posts of trade and mines, as well as land reform, in which they contain very controversial policies of black economic empowerment. What he's done is give specific portfolios to the main coalition alliance, the Democratic Alliance, giving them the agricultural position, which went to the DA leader, John Steenhuisen, as well as home affairs, where there's an illegal immigration crisis that the opposition party will have to deal with. But I think a lot of analysts are saying it was a juggling act that he managed to handle quite smoothly.
A juggling act, but will it be a challenging time to keep all these people working together effectively in government?
I think that has been the concern, and that was foreshadowed by all of the tense negotiations that led up to this particular announcement. This cabinet was supposed to have been announced last week, but it took weeks and weeks of negotiations. And at some point last week, there was an understanding that it could actually collapse because the parties were haggling over positions. And I think the fact that they've come up with this particular cabinet, a lot of people see that as a result of Cyril Ramaphosa's negotiating skills. Many people remember that he was a key negotiator to the end of apartheid. And so I think there's a lot of optimism about him being able to control all of the parties. And he alluded to that in his speech, trying to reassure South Africans, saying that this partnership will be guided by a statement of intent, which outlines fundamental principles and minimum programs of priorities. So in essence, what he's saying is that they've already agreed about how they're going to work together. But this is a disparate group of political parties, 11 of them. Many of them have diametrically opposed policies. And so it'll be interesting to see how this new political creature will work together going forward.
Shingai Nyoka. Taliban officials from Afghanistan have been attending UN-led talks in Qatar for the first time. But at their insistence, women have been banned from the gathering. The United Nations says the meetings are an opportunity to interact with the Taliban on vital issues and are not tantamount to a recognition of their administration. The agenda includes restrictions imposed on Afghanistan's banking system, as well as tackling the narcotics trade. Fawzia Koofi is a former Afghan MP. She says the UN has set a dangerous precedent by not including women in the talks.
If the UN, an organization which is mandated to protect human rights based on its charter, they need to ensure 50% of women inclusion in all the processes, and that is the whole. If the same organization is doing contradiction to their values, then who should we go for protection of our rights?
Our correspondent Caroline Davies is in Doha.
This is obviously slightly controversial because of the agreement that the UN came to in order to be able to get the Taliban around that table. They had discussions that were scheduled and happened in February this year. At that stage, the Taliban did not turn up, partly because they said they didn't want to be sitting around the table with people from civil society. They wanted to be the only ones at the table recognised as the authority in Afghanistan. Now, this time round, there are no people from civil society at that talks with the Taliban there. That means that there will be no women from Afghanistan representing Afghanistan at those talks. And that's been something that has really spurred a large amount of anger and criticism from human rights groups, from civil society activists as well. Some of them who've saying that the UN has ultimately caved to the Taliban and the Taliban's requirements and are worried about this setting a dangerous precedent. Now, the UN have tried to improve the situation by saying things like they are planning to have a civil society's meeting happening once the Taliban have left town on Tuesday. However, we know that quite a few people that have been invited to those talks from civil society have said that they are boycotting that event because of the fact that the UN are meeting with the Taliban without having civil society around the table. The UN's argument would probably be, not that they are speaking on record about it, that they simply wanted to get the Taliban at the table to have some form of meaningful discussion.
Now, this meaningful discussion is going to include economic issues, issues around counter-narcotics. Would we be expecting the plight of women within Afghanistan to nonetheless be discussed, despite the absence of women?
So that is the other thing that has caused some form of consternation, and that is the fact that on the official agenda, those are the two topics, counter-narcotics and economic sort of private sector discussions. Now, officially, human rights is not something that's on the agenda. However, talking to delegates here, it's clear that there are certain countries that have said that they are going to emphasise this while they have those other discussions. So, for example, when they're talking about the private sector, they will bring up the role of women in society. And they have said that they will make it clear their stances on things like human rights and women's rights and women's roles in society and education, various different things that they have been completely excluded from since the Taliban have come into power. But it's difficult to know because, of course, all of this is going to be happening behind closed doors.
The BBC's Caroline Davis in Doha. For the last 15 years, Nigerians living in the northeast of the country have suffered at the hands of a ruthless insurgency by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram. On Saturday, at least 18 people were killed and more than 30 injured in three bomb blasts at a wedding, a hospital and a funeral. Richard Hamilton reports.
Although Boko Haram has not admitted carrying out these attacks, they bear all the hallmarks of their relentless violence. Eyewitnesses said the first bomber was a mother in her 20s, carrying a baby on her back, who pretended to be a wedding guest. She stormed the venue in the town of Goza and detonated a device. The wounded were rushed to the local hospital, but about 10 minutes later, another blast went off there. As one of the victims was being buried shortly afterwards, in accordance with Islam, a teenager disguised herself as a mourner at the funeral and set off yet another bomb. Idris Mohammed is a researcher who has analysed and documented incidents of terrorism in the town.
Goza is at the border with Cameroon, far away from the state capital, and it is one of the most affected communities in Borno State. I think it recorded the highest number of insurgent people. So there are so many people that are trying to survive. There are forests and mountains, so it is easier for the Boko Haram members to come and attack communities.
The authorities have declared a 48-hour curfew in Goza. But long-term solutions remain elusive, and successive Nigerian governments have failed to stop the bloodshed. Poverty, marginalisation and military abuses make it easy for the Islamists to recruit more fighters and suicide bombers. In 2015, the previous president, Muhammadu Buhari, announced that Boko Haram had been technically defeated. Nearly a decade later, those words are sounding increasingly hollow.
Richard Hamilton. The people of St. Vincent and the Grenadines are bracing themselves for Hurricane Beryl, the first hurricane of the 2024 season and earlier in the year than normal. Ralph Gonsalves is the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. He's been speaking to Owen Bennett-Jones. When is the Prime Minister expecting the hurricane to hit?
Sometime mid-morning, tomorrow, Monday, the 1st of July. It's coming from the south, past Barbados, and then into the Grenadine Islands, which are part of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And it's continuing on that path, the small islands in the Grenadines, and then on to St. Vincent itself. The hurricane force winds will hit us by mid-morning. So we're making all the preparations.
Okay, well, what do the preparations for that look like? Do you move people or do you just build barricades? What are you doing?
Well, we have shelters all across the country. We are opening the shelters tonight, this evening at 6 p.m. And we have district committees. We have a good National Emergency Management Organization. I've had a meeting with them. I'm the chairman of that body. And we put all systems in place. We have emergency plans for those whose houses may not be able to withstand winds 115, 120 and upwards, because it's a category 4. It will go to 130 and gust higher. We have shelters across the country. We have food supplies and water, put security systems in place. We should be able to ride it out, God willing.
What happens if some people refuse to go in the shelters? I guess that quite often happens in many places. Do you have that issue?
We don't have that issue so much. It's just to get them to be there on time. You may have some late comers. I just want them to get on time. I've given instructions that I don't want anybody on the streets after 7 p.m. this evening, so that we brace ourselves overnight for what is going to happen in the morning, and people make all their preparations. And I say, of course, the shelters will be open at 6 o'clock. But those have to go. And everybody has his own family emergency plan. We have a good system, not perfect, but it has been honed through many disasters. And of course, in 2021, we had the volcanic eruptions and we had to evacuate 1/5 of the population into shelters. Of course, preparing for a volcano, volcanic eruptions, it's different in many respects to that of a hurricane. But there's some similar modalities. We are beginning to prepare for what's going to happen after Monday. The seas are very warm. Global warming is not only on the earth, on the landmass, sorry, but on the seas. And that's facilitating, engendering hurricanes and storms of greater intensities and frequency. Unfortunately, the major emitters are not taking it as seriously as they should. A lot of talk on it, but not a lot of action.
Ralph Gonsalves, Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Still to come, the BBC uncovers fresh evidence that Israeli troops strapped wounded Palestinians to their jeeps during action in the West Bank city of Jenin. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said his country's troops are engaged in a difficult fight with Hamas in several areas of Gaza. The most intense clashes in recent days have been in a district of Gaza City, but there's also been fighting in other areas, and a major operation is continuing in the southern city of Rafah. Our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher, sent this report from Jerusalem.
Mourners carry the bodies of six members of the same family killed in Rafah. The local authorities say they died when their building was hit in an Israeli strike. The Israeli military says it severely degraded the capabilities of three of the four Hamas battalions that it says have been operating in the city. But elsewhere, Palestinian fighters have regrouped in areas from which they were driven months ago. For the past 4 days, battle has raged in Meshujaiya district in Gaza City. The Israeli army says at least 40 Hamas fighters have been killed and several tunnels destroyed. Two Israeli soldiers have been killed, while residents say the assault has left bodies lying in the street. Mr. Netanyahu says the fighting is being waged above and below ground, sometimes in hand-to-hand combat. Last week, he said the intensive phase of the war was nearing its end, but that's not how it feels on the ground in Gaza.
Louise Wateridge is a spokesperson for UNRWA, the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees. She's currently in the Nuseirat camp in central Gaza.
As I speak to you now from the middle area of the Gaza Strip, I can hear bombardments everywhere. I can hear them in the south. I can hear them coming from the north. It's just constant, and it just spreads fear for everyone around us. The north it's apocalyptic. There's no other way to describe it. Going through Gaza City, everywhere you look, the buildings are not buildings anymore. They are shells. You can see life that used to be there. And the sad reality is people now are faced with the decision of living back in these buildings. They're putting up sheets of plastic or carpet or anything to protect them from the sun now that we've entered the summer months. Or they're living in and among piles of trash and piles of rubbish. There's no water. There's nowhere to go to the bathroom. It's very, very basic, and there's very limited supplies available to the population. We have doctors, we have nurses, we have people in our clinics, but if we don't have the medicine to give the patients, there's very limited we can do. With these access restrictions from the Israeli authorities, it is incredibly difficult, if not nearly impossible, for us to deliver humanitarian response.
Louise Wateridge of UNRWA talking from central Gaza. Meanwhile, on the occupied West Bank, the BBC has found evidence that Israeli troops carried injured Palestinian men on the bonnet of a military jeep at least 3 times during an operation in Jenin last month. Last week, video footage emerged of one man, Mujahid Abadi Balas, being driven on the front of an army vehicle, sparking an international outcry. The BBC has now spoken to 2 more people who say the same thing happened to them. Lucy Williamson reports from Jenin.
On a winding village road outside Jenin, an Israeli military jeep drives past waiting Palestinian ambulances. Stretched out on its bonnet, a Palestinian man, one arm clinging to the vehicle, the other lying motionless across his body, with what appears to be a large bloodstain near the shoulder. The figure on the bonnet was 23-year-old Mujahid Abadi Balas, shot during an Israeli operation last weekend.
Did you watch that?
More than a week on, Mujahid is lying in a hospital bed, the gunshot wounds to his leg and shoulder framed with external metal fixtures, burns on his back from the hot metal of the military jeep.
They were beating me on the injury in my leg and shoulder. They were checking where my injuries were and beating me there.
He shows me another video in which a group of soldiers appear to pick him up and throw him onto the vehicle.
What was it like?
I was saying my final prayers. I was expecting to die.
Mujahid's story caused international outrage, but it's not the only one. In the hospital, we also met Samir Dabaya. Shot in the back during the same military raid. And he says, carried to an army vehicle, stripped of his trousers and thrown onto the bonnet. A few brief seconds of footage from a nearby security camera appear to show him, half naked, on the same army jeep. Both men say they were shot around a house in the Jabriyat area of Jenin as Israeli forces came to arrest a wanted man. The walls there still marked by sniper fire.
To where the jeep came.
At the house, a third man, Hesham Islet, a large bandage on his leg, shows me the olive grove, where he says he too was shot and then forced onto the hot metal bonnet of the same military vehicle.
These tracks here, I guess, yeah.
I tried to put my hand on the jeep. I couldn't. It was burning hot. But they forced me, saying that I should get on it if I didn't want to die.
All three men were later released by Israeli forces. The army said Mujahid's case violated orders and procedures and would be investigated, and that the new allegations we put to them were under review. During an Israeli operation this week, bombs buried deep in the roads hit troops as they drove in, killing one soldier and wounding 16 others. This battle began long before the Gaza war, but tactics here on both sides are shifting in its wake, and the behaviour of Israeli troops is under scrutiny here too. This is different territory to Gaza, but it's the same adversaries, the same war.
Lucy Williamson. Australia is bringing in some of the toughest legislation in the world around vaping. From Monday, the sale of e-cigarettes outside of pharmacies will be prohibited, a measure designed to curtail a boom in youth vaping. As our Australia correspondent Katie Watson now reports from Sydney.
Australia had wanted to be a world first in banning vaping without a prescription, but opposition from the Green Party has meant that original plan got watered down. As of Monday, it will be illegal to supply, manufacture, import or sell a vape outside of pharmacy. That applies to all e-cigarettes, whether they have nicotine or not. Those purchasing a vape will have to have a prescription until October. After that, they'll be able to buy one after having a conversation with their pharmacist. Under 18s, though, will still need a prescription. Australia has some of the toughest anti-smoking laws in the world. It banned the import of vapes earlier this year and limited the number of flavours that can be sold. In 2012, Australia also became the first country to pass a law on plain packaging for tobacco products, reducing its marketing appeal.
Glastonbury is the largest music festival in Europe. It's held in the west of England every summer. Thousands of music lovers camp out, hoping to get a glimpse of some of their favourite artists. Headliners at this year's five-day festival have included Coldplay and Dua Lipa. But there's also been a new addition to the stage, the voice of Bacaprot, the first Indonesian band to play there. The band's made up of three women in hijabs. They've been talking to our culture reporter, Noor Nanji.
Oh, my name is Marcia. I'm the guitarist and vocalist.
My name is Siti. I'm a drummer.
I'm Rudy. I'm a bass player.
I mean, you're the first Indonesian band to play at Glastonbury. How does that feel?
Very excited. Yeah, so proud. And also, this is a big responsibility because we are become the representation of Indonesia.
but a little nervous.
We are so proud to be in here. I feel like I am falling, pushed down,
swallowed by the What's it like to be an all-female metal band in a Muslim country? Have you faced a lot of obstacles?
First, yeah. because many people misunderstood about metal music. But now after they knew that metal music is just medium for us to express ourselves, they give us full support.
What has the reaction been to your music in the UK and also at home? Have you had a positive reaction?
Oh, yeah. On 26th June, we are performing in London. So many people came to our show and they are very supportive and excited about our show. Yeah.
And this is your first time in the UK. Do you like it?
Yeah. I like it so much.
But it's cold.
Sorry about that. Hopefully the sun comes out soon. Good luck with your set.
Thank you so much.
Noor Nanji there with the members of the Voice of Bacheprot. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Bernadette Keogh. Until next time, goodbye.